KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners weekly meeting in progress for this week's public health updates, held as a virtual meeting during the pandemic. Jefferson County Public Health Officer Dr. Allison Berry and Department of Emergency Management Director Willie Bentz will now brief our commissioners and you, our KPTZ listeners.
Dr. Berry, and I see, I always want to call him Dr. Willie. Director Willie. What do you have for us this week, Dr. Berry?
Good morning. Nice to see everyone. So we do have some continued improving news on the COVID-19 front. We continue to see cases go down nationally, where we are seeing death rates decrease as well. Though I think it is still important to acknowledge that that is from an incredibly high peak under the Omicron wave. So we are still losing approximately 1,500 Americans every day due to COVID-19. And I think that's always important to keep in perspective as we move towards normalization of our day-to-day functions. There is a tendency to say, you know, COVID is over, or that COVID has become the flu. And so for comparison, on a bad flu year, we lose about 80 to 100 Americans every day. We've never had a flu that took out 1,500 people every day. So things are getting better, but we are still seeing a lot of transmission in our country, in our state, and in our region. In Washington State, case rates are decreasing as well. In Jefferson County, we are also seeing our case numbers go down. Currently, the total number of cases we have diagnosed is 3,103. That puts our case rate at 385 per 100,000 with a 10% positivity. So that is about 40% down in the last week. We are continuing to see things come down, but they aren't dropping quite as steeply as we have seen in some other places. And we can talk a little bit about why that is. We do have 4 of our residents currently hospitalized for a total of 115 hospitalizations in this response. And we have lost 28 of our residents to COVID-19. In neighboring Clallam County, we are up to 10,833 cases of COVID-19. Our current case rate is actually down a little bit below the Jefferson case rate at 230 per 100,000 with a 7.3% positivity rate. And we have 5 of our residents currently hospitalized. We have had 104 deaths in Clallam County, which is 2 new deaths as of today. We lost one of our residents who was in his 80s and unvaccinated, and another resident who was in his 80s, vaccinated but not boosted, and who had underlying conditions. So a little bit about case counts. Actually, one of our KPTZ listeners brought up the complexity of determining COVID case numbers. And I think it's important to acknowledge that our case counts are and have always been an undercount of cases. They only include the people who got tested and who reported those results if it's an antigen test. In the beginning, they were limited by a shortage of tests. Now they continue to be limited by people's inability sometimes to recognize that they have COVID symptoms, so they might not get tested, or they might not report. One big difference that's important to note is in state and national numbers, they do not include antigen tests. So all of those case rates that you see reported at the federal or state level actually are only PCRs. That didn't used to make as big of a difference when very few people were using antigen tests. But in the last month or so, hundreds of millions of antigen tests were pushed out to the public. And so some of that rapid drop-off you see in the federal numbers are actually just a transition to antigen tests and the failure of our current system to pick up those antigen tests. We are seeing percent positivities decrease. So we do think we are seeing that decrease is real, but it's probably not as sharp as it looks on the graph that you see at the federal and state level. In Jefferson and Clallam County, we actually count antigen tests in our rates because we think that's accurate. And especially as we've seen so many of our citizens transition to antigen tests, we think it's important to gather those numbers. But we know that those are only the antigen tests that are reported to us. And so those are always an undercount too. So one thing you may notice is I'm very cautious with my wording. We have documented these cases. We have documented 3,103 cases, but those are only the ones that we know about. Generally, depending on our percent positivity, we have anywhere from 3 to 10 times that number of cases in the community at any given time. Right now, we're assessing what's called an ascertainment bias of 4, which means that we expect there are about 4 times as many cases out there as we are aware of. But things are moving in the right direction. We are happy to see them continue to move in that direction. This is the week that the state and local mask mandates, as well as proof of vaccination orders, are going to be lifted. I wanted to talk a little bit about that transition because I know there are a lot of questions. There are some concerns about that transition. So I want to try to explain a little bit about what's going on. We are in the process of transitioning from the pandemic response to the endemic phase of our response. And what does that mean? And what does it not mean? So you will probably have already heard the term endemic floated around in media. There are some things that it means and some things that it doesn't. There is a tendency, I think, for some folks to think endemic means mild or not dangerous. It does not. Endemic means something that is with us. It means a disease that is going to be with us for a while. There are many diseases that are endemic, things like the herpes virus, things like malaria. There's a whole range of severity. It just means a disease that's with us. But when we're transitioning from the pandemic phase of our response to the endemic phase of the response, what that means is we are transitioning to a period in our response where we don't think that COVID-19 is going to overwhelm critical parts of our infrastructure. So we don't think COVID-19 is going to overwhelm our healthcare system or, you know, our county government or, you know, the people who fix the roads. We think that society will be able to continue to function with this level of disease that we have right now, which doesn't mean that it's not a severe amount of disease, and it doesn't mean it can't still hurt you. What it does mean is that the primary motivation for things like mandates, keeping society functioning, keeping our healthcare system functioning, we think those are safe, which is when we transition away from mandates to recommendations. The primary basis for mandates is keeping society functioning. So that's why you're seeing this week, this transition from mandates to recommendations. And so we are moving to not mandating masks in indoor spaces, but we do still recommend them in indoor spaces. And the primary reason we still recommend them is that our case rates are still relatively high. Case rates are really a proxy for probability. They are the probability that someone in any given room has COVID-19. And so when you see those case rates get low enough, the probability that you will get exposed in an indoor space goes down. So right now in Jefferson County, if you walk into a room with 25 people, and you're all unmasked, there is a 17% probability that one of those people has COVID. And so that's why we still recommend you wear a mask, because that's a pretty high probability that someone has COVID-19. When we see those case rates continue to go down, when they get to less than 100 cases per 100,000, that probability goes down to 5%. And so that's why we think it's reasonable to start unmasking when we get to that rate. We have just posted on our Jefferson County Public Health Facebook page a dial to kind of help guide people around that. None of these will be required after the mask mandate gets lifted, but we have heard a lot of confusion in the community about whether or not to wear masks and when it's reasonable to make that decision. And so one key piece of information when you make that decision is the case rate in the community. That's how you know the probability that anyone has COVID. We strongly recommend masking when case rates are above 200 cases per 100,000 in pretty much all indoor settings. When we get to below 100 cases per 100,000, it's reasonable for people to start unmasking in indoor spaces if they're not high risk. We do recommend that people who are high risk continue to mask until we get to an even lower case rate of less than 50 per 100,000, because we just really want to protect folks. And so we're hoping that will help guide people as they make those decisions in these public places after the mask mandate is lifted. I do think there have been many cases in our response where the communication from our federal partners has been less than ideal. And the communication around mask mandate changes in the last couple of weeks has fallen in that category. And so I think it's left a lot of people confused about what they should do. We're hoping that this dial can help guide folks. We will update it as we move through it. And we do think that we're gonna be moving below that 200 range in the next week or two, and then likely below that 100 range in the next couple of weeks after that. So we do think we're moving to a safer place, but we do recommend continuing to mask in indoor spaces until we get to that safer place that will protect you and that will protect the people around you. I do want to remind folks that one of the big reasons that we wear masks is not just to protect ourselves, but protect the other people around us. There are people in our community who are immunosuppressed, who are elderly, who have underlying medical conditions that we do still want to mask around whenever we're in their company to try to keep them safe until we know that COVID-19 is really more behind us than it is right now. And so with that, I see Commissioner Brotherton has a question already.
Sorry, prompted by your statement just now. I just want to be absolutely clear. And this doesn't come, this is not a leading question, I hope, but it doesn't look like we're going to be below 200 cases per 100,000 per 14 days by March 11th. And we're still going forward with the movements, both in the requirement in restaurants and the masking. Or can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So I do think it's reasonable to move forward with lifting those requirements at the same time that the state lifts the mask mandate. It's not, you know, it's not as perfect of a number as I would like to see. But I just don't think that it will be tenable to maintain mandates longer than the state. And so I think it's reasonable to lift the mandate. However, it is still within the purview of any business to maintain those rules. And I think it's important for all of us to acknowledge that. There will likely be businesses in our community that continue to require either proof of vaccination or masking or both. And to support and understand that, it is a risky move as a business to do that. People know that people are going to get mad at them. Anytime that I have seen a business do that, it is because someone who works there is high risk. And so they're making that decision to protect their employees and to make sure they protect their families. And so if you see a requirement of a business that lasts longer than the local and state mandates, know that that is likely because someone really needs that who works there. And let's show compassion and support for our neighbors. There's another local business that let us know that their policy will be that their employees will be mask optional after the mandate is lifted, but that their requirement is that if a visitor comes up to that employee in a mask, that they will put a mask on out of compassion and care for that person. And I think that's a really good rule that many of us could follow. If you are going to be talking close to someone who has a mask on, they probably would prefer that you wear one too. And we could wear a mask when we're close to each other, when we see that we're around someone with the mask on, because most likely that person might have an underlying condition you don't know about, and they're trying to keep themselves and their family members safe.
Thank you.
Thank you. Along that line, it is possible that Clallam County will dip below 200 cases per 100,000 before March 11th. And so if that happens, and we can maintain it for at least 24 hours, we want to make sure that it's a real dip, then we will go ahead and lift the proof of vaccination order before the 11th. But either way, they're all going to go away on the 11th. Thank you for that clarifying question. That is
yeah. Any other questions I have? And I'll have lots. I'll wait till after KPTZ questions. But thank you, Doctor.
So I know that Commissioner Dean had to jump off. She had another meeting she needed to attend for a few minutes now. I have one question, but I feel like you've addressed this, but I just want to say it again. Based on a public comment we got over the last week. So the connection between animals and COVID transmission, There was a public comment that came in talking about wild or partially domesticated animals in our community, like the deer and, and is there any evidence of transmission from animals, like commonly found in our community?
No. Good clarifying question. This kind of comes to one of the KPTZ questions too. So a lot of this really stemmed from looking at where COVID-19 likely came from. And there was a theory that was tossed out that it might have come from a lab in China. And while it's very difficult to fully disprove that theory, we found no evidence to support that theory, that by far the most likely source of COVID-19 is what's called an animal reservoir. So an animal that can maintain a coronavirus. There are many animal reservoirs for viruses and bacterial infections for many different kinds of infections. There are many infections that can live in animals for a long period of time. The challenge and the atypical thing that can happen in some rare instances is a virus can move from an animal into a person. So when it comes to COVID-19, we have found that there are animals that can carry the virus, but we have not found that there are many instances of animals that can take the virus from them to us. So there are some known animal reservoirs for COVID-19 that we have found. Cats is one you might remember when some big cats contracted COVID-19 in New York, but they can't give it back to us. We can give COVID to cats, they cannot give it to us. Similarly, deer can carry COVID-19. We have no evidence that deer can transmit COVID-19 to humans. So you don't have to fear the deer in our community. They are not giving us COVID-19. The source of COVID-19 for us is other people. So there are many animals that we can infect, but who can't go on to bring the virus back to us. Dogs can also contract COVID-19, but cannot give it back to humans.
Thank you for clarifying.
Yeah, no worries.
That's a fascinating conversation, right? And then MERS came from dromedaries and SARS came from like a civet cat or a bat. I mean, a lot of diseases do come from people correctly, but it's like, it's a perfect moment when it's evolved to the point that, oh, now it can jump to a human host and isn't the norm, but it's one of those mutating exceptions that becomes the norm.
Yes. So for instance, avian influenza classically can sometimes mutates to the point that it can go from birds to people. And so what is the most likely source of COVID-19 is there are bats in China that carry coronaviruses regularly. And one of them mutated to be able to move from bats to people. The other next step that you have to have in order to have a pandemic is not just to go from animal to person, but then to have person to person transmission thereafter. That is very, very atypical, but that is what happened in the COVID-19 scenario. But that can happen, and we have seen that in other viruses. And so I think that does bring up one critical thing that we do need to pay attention for preventing subsequent pandemics. And that is that close human-animal contact in wild spaces for prolonged periods of time does carry some risk. And so particularly when we talk about deforestation and moving further and further into our wild spaces, there is some increased risk of human-animal transfer of various pathogens. It's something to pay attention to as we plan for how to prevent future pandemics. One other part of that, actually, while we're on the preventing future pandemics train, is regular surveillance. So there are communities that we know live very closely with the wild environment, and that's a part of their standard practice. But what we could do differently in the future is some regular surveillance to see if they're picking up viruses that could then spread to other human beings.
My question kind of came from a follow-on from our beginning of the conversation last week about animals and the spread of disease and you know, my reflection on my experience and how it was likely a mosquito, but I was in an agricultural area and the mosquito likely was the vector and got the disease from an animal like a pig or in that area. So it's fascinating. Yeah. We live in a very porous world.
Well, and you know, those who work in agriculture likely know that there are lots of diseases that your animals can get, and some of them can transfer to humans. And so those who are used to working in an agricultural sector are aware of this. But yeah. I think many of us who live in cities have not spent so much time paying attention to the health of our neighboring animals.
Right. Well, I think that's it for commissioner questions.
Okay, so we've kind of We've kind of dug into a few of the KP2C questions already around why we remove mandates, what the barometer is on masking, also on the fact that we do undercount cases. We know that. So these really give us trends over time. We follow multiple different data points in order to really make sure that we're getting an accurate picture. And one is percent positivity. Our percent positivity is actually only of PCR specimens from our local hospitals. So in Clallam County, it's the Olympic Medical Center PCRs is where that percent positivity comes from. In Jefferson County, it's Jefferson Healthcare's PCRs. And so we do think that's a pretty accurate assessment because they test a wide variety of people who are sick, who are getting pre-surgical clearance. So 10% positivity is still pretty high. And we do still have quite a bit of transmission in our community. We'd like to see that number get to less than 5% before we would feel comfortable that we really are seeing low level disease transmission. One person said they are 80 and healthy, and their wife is just a few years younger and also healthy. And they wanted to know when we would recommend stopping wearing masks in indoor settings. So given this person's age, being over 65 does put you at high risk for COVID-19. So we do recommend masking in indoor settings until we get to less than 50 cases per 100,000. Now, if you are 80, vaccinated and boosted, if you've done all these other things to improve your safety in those spaces, it might be reasonable to lift that number to closer to 100, like we see with the rest of the population. However, if you have significant underlying medical conditions, if you're immunosuppressed, if you have cancer, anything like that, we really recommend following that lower threshold of 50 cases per 100,000, because we know that it's going to be challenging for your body to fully respond to its vaccine. And we want to do everything we can to protect you in the weeks ahead. This person said, why have schools continued to require outdoor masking and distancing despite the science showing that it is unnecessary? I am not sure which schools are requiring outdoor masking. That would be atypical. Most of our schools do not require outdoor masking. Some schools require masking right as they move into the school. And so some of that is just for ease of masking, because taking masks on and off right as you do drop off can be challenging. Some kids prefer to keep their masks on. And I think it is important to acknowledge that there are schools, schools have the ability to institute rules that are more stringent than anything that comes from our department. But I would say that we do not see transmission in outdoor settings. And so it is very reasonable to unmask in outdoor settings. If your child attends a school that requires outdoor masking, I would recommend talking to that administrator so that you can better understand the policy. They can have more stringent policies than mine. Most commonly when I have seen that, it's a temporary measure. So it's on your way in and out of spaces, but it'd be worth talking to your school administrator about it. Yes, Commissioner Brotherton. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt the KPTZ questions, but to apply this question to the county, we're gonna be reassessing our 10th policy on COVID, the COVID emergency today, later today. Mm-hmm. And included in that is a recommendation to always mask, which is, of course, we have both indoor and outdoor spaces, and also that masks are not required outdoors. Should that be not recommended outdoors, not necessary outdoors? I mean, not required implies recommendation, especially when coupled with the recommendation to always mask. So I'm just wondering, is that a little more draconian for outdoor spaces than we need?
Yes, I think we could be much clearer about that and say we recommend masking when in indoor spaces. We still do not see transmission of COVID-19 in outdoor spaces with things like Omicron. We did see there were a couple rare instances where we saw transmission with Delta. So one was football when we were at scrimmage lines. It's a very unique scenario where you're face to face with someone spitting basically in each other's faces. That's atypical. Please don't do that in an outdoor setting. But otherwise, if you're working on a road crew, if you're walking through a farmer's market, you don't need a mask in an outdoor setting.
Only in scrums. Thank you.
Yes. So if you are playing football or rugby, consider masking up when you're in close spaces, or making sure that you have other safety precautions involved. You made sure everyone's vaccinated and boosted, things like that. All right. Couple other things. We talked a little bit about the source of COVID-19. We've really delved into quite a few of our KPTZ questions today. One person was asking, would it make sense at some point to require a proof of vaccination for places like movie theaters rather than requiring masking? I would say there are lots of different steps that individual businesses can take to make their spaces safer. So one is to require masking. One is to require proof of vaccination. You can require both. I think it is reasonable as we see case numbers go down to remove some of those mandates and to scale back some of those precautions. The things that we need to do to keep ourselves safe when we have thousands of cases per 100,000 are different than the things that we need to do when we have lower case rates and higher rates of population immunity through vaccination and some degree of prior infection. And that's really the change we're seeing now, is that so many of us are either vaccinated and boosted or they got Omicron, or in some rare cases got both. And all of those things together have decreased the probability that we'll see really a true super spreader event in an indoor space like we used to see in earlier parts of this pandemic response. So I think it depends on the business, but you can kind of pick and choose what makes the most sense for your space. Both of those could be reasonable, but likely you're not gonna need both, not when case rates are low. And that's part of why we also plan to keep this kind of barometer available for folks, is that we do anticipate there will be a day when case numbers will rise again. Right now, we think that's more likely to be in the fall when we all come back indoors. It's been a little while since we were either vaccinated or exposed. And so some of our immunity is likely to wane. And so when we see those case numbers trend back up, it's reasonable to bring back some more of those safety precautions that we can let go when case numbers are low. This person says, do you feel it is safe to eat out in restaurants again, given that our case rates are still higher than you want to see? I would say it depends a lot on your circumstance. I do think our case rates are in a much lower space than they were before, and they're continuing to trend down. If you are well and vaccinated and boosted, I do think it is reasonable to eat out right now. But if you are elderly, immunosuppressed, not vaccinated, I would actually recommend we get all the way below 200 cases per 100,000 before we start going back into indoor spaces with our masks off, which we do in restaurant settings. But if you have all those other safety mechanisms in place, I do think it's reasonable to eat out indoors. And of course, the proof of vaccination requirement is still in place. And so now is a pretty safe time to support our local restaurants. If it makes you uncomfortable, certainly eating outdoors, getting takeout can be another good option. This person says, do you feel it is safe to travel to other areas where we know that case rates are higher and there are fewer mandates? I still don't feel comfortable traveling on a plane or a bus in an enclosed space for a prolonged time without ventilation and people are unmasked. And I read there's about 15% of the population that are not vaccinated at all. It depends on where you are. In some places in the country, that number is quite a bit higher than 15%, closer to 40% of the population that is unvaccinated. The safety of spaces like planes and trains and buses depends a lot on yourself and on the other people there. Right now, it is still mandated to wear a mask in those spaces. Places like planes have really good ventilation systems that turn on once you're fully in the air. So if you're thinking about traveling, I recommend wearing a high quality mask, so a KN95, KF94, or an N95 if you can tolerate it. And it's most critical for takeoff, landing, and taxi, because that's when those fans are off. So you wanna wear your mask well until you're up in the air, kind of at cruising altitude, and then they have really good ventilation systems, so it is safer. So if you do all of those things, wear your mask well in the airport, you can travel in a safer way. And certainly we recommend you be vaccinated and boosted before you do that. All right, couple other questions. This person says, I read that only 30% of vaccinated people went on to get the second shot or the booster. I don't see them as safe to be around, as my understanding is that the booster is fairly crucial with Omicron. Is this accurate? So one part of that is accurate, which is that the booster is critical when it comes to Omicron. So we do really recommend not only that everyone go forward and get vaccinated, but also go on to get their booster. The good news is those numbers are not quite accurate. So actually in Jefferson County, we have the highest rate of folks who have gone on to get their booster. So 72% of those who are eligible for their booster have gotten it, which is an incredibly high percentage and the highest percentage in the state of Washington. We also have the highest one of the highest percentages of our population that are fully vaccinated, which is 76%. We were beat out by King and San Juan for that one, but we actually beat them when it comes to boosters. Interestingly, our neighbor Clallam County is actually number 4 on both of those metrics. So despite being somewhat politically different, we have some of the best vaccination rates in the state, and Washington has one of the highest vaccination rates in the country. So we have done really quite well. Most people who are vaccinated in Jefferson are actually boosted as well. If you haven't gotten your booster yet, I do recommend you go forward and get it. It's really critical for protecting yourself from infection, and especially if you're high risk, it's actually still protecting yourself from severe disease. This one says, could you comment on super spreader events at this stage in the pandemic? I haven't heard mention of it lately, especially after things like the Super Bowl. Great question. We did have some spike in transmission related to the Super Bowl. So some of our cases actually were related to Super Bowl parties in the couple weeks after the Super Bowl, but we are not seeing super spreader events the same way we used to. And we think the primary driver of that is so many of us have some degree of immunity. So we are either vaccinated and boosted, or we got Omicron, or we got a little bit of both. And all of those things together are preventing a lot of transmission. And we're even seeing that in household spaces, where we're seeing an individual turn positive and then not give it to their family because they're vaccinated, their family's all vaccinated and boosted. That's the big difference now compared to earlier stages of the pandemic. And that's why you're seeing pandemic restrictions change. We used to need more of these things because if you walked into a space and you had COVID, no one was immune. And so you would see some of the church outbreaks that we used to get where we'd get hundreds of cases. We don't see that anymore. And that's because so many people have some degree of immunity. And that's why I do think it's reasonable to scale back some of these mandates. This one was talking about assessing case counts. They were also talking about the fact that we know that our case counts are an undercount, and they recommended transitioning to wastewater surveillance. I would note that we actually have some parts of Clallam County that are involved in wastewater surveillance, and Washington State as a whole is starting to include wastewater surveillance in their COVID-19 surveillance mechanism. I would say wastewater surveillance does provide a lot of good things. It doesn't rely on case reporting. It also is really good at what's called sentinel surveillance. So it's really good at finding COVID when you don't have any COVID in the community. We use some of that in our most rural parts of Clallam County when they didn't have COVID yet. And then from the wastewater, we started to see when it arrived. So it's really good when case numbers are very, very low. It's also good at giving trends. But what it can't do yet is give you an absolute amount of COVID in your community. So it can't replace case counts, but I think it is an important adjunct, and you'll likely see more of it both locally and at the state and federal level as well. And that is all the KPTZ questions today.
Thank you, Dr. Berry. Any follow-on questions from anyone else in the Zoom room? Greg, Mark, Willie?
I just don't know what Willie's gonna do with 13 minutes. But I'm curious to see.
Willie, the floor is yours. What's going on in your world?
I certainly don't have 13 minutes worth of content, so I'm sorry to disappoint you, Commissioner. There's really not a whole heck of a lot going on in our world. As I mentioned, that the past couple of weeks, we're focused on starting our after action review of the response. So we have that coming up here by the end of the month, really. For the most part, we did hear over the weekend that a grocery store or two had run out of N95, so we'll be looking to restock those relatively shortly. We'll continue to keep those places stocked with masks as long as that state program is up and running. We remain available here at the EOC call center. Call us and leave a message if you're looking for a booster dose, if you have questions, if you're homebound and have a limited mobility. We're happy to come and pay you a visit. But really, again, as we're making this transition, it's been pretty it's been quieter than it has been. I don't want to say it's been quieter. So that's really it for me. I, you know, had 13 and used just about one. So again, apologies, but happy to answer any questions.
Maybe a question for both of you. How do you characterize the rate at which people are still pursuing vaccines? I mean, are our pharmacies still having a trickle of people coming through, or is it completely dried up? I mean, what's the vaccine kind of landscape currently?
I would say it's still, a trickle is probably accurate. So we're seeing our percent of the population vaccinated still increase, but by a little under 1% a week. So people are getting vaccinated. We have seen a rise in vaccinations for kids in our community. I think particularly as we move closer to lifting mask mandates in schools, many parents have decided to move forward with getting their kids vaccinated to make sure that they're well protected before that time. That's still relatively low numbers. So 53% of our middle and high school aged kids are fully vaccinated in this region, but we are moving into higher numbers there, and we certainly continue to have vaccinations available and boosters available for our community. And I do want to give a shout out to our Department of Emergency Management volunteers and Willie Bentz here for getting us to that number of having some of the highest rates, the highest rate of those who have gotten boosters in the state. That was a nearly all volunteer effort. With very few resources, and they did a fantastic job.
Well, I guess I have a question about vaccines. I mean, we're still a ways to go, I would say, as a community. Wondering, I know that at least during the point of time count, OLECAP had gotten some grant for incentivizing folks that decide to get vaccinated now. And I'm wondering, is it time to do another round of incentives for folks that are, you know, maybe they're on the fence with the kid as we come into a new phase or something, but I guess I'll bring information next week about that program, but I'm just wondering if its incentives might be timely at this point, at this juncture.
I think it's certainly an option to help kind of tilt, you know, if that helps folks get kind of over the hurdle. Certainly the other thing that we're always happy to do is if we do see an increased demand in an area, make vaccination as convenient as possible. So while we have largely scaled back our clinics, if we had a school that said they had 100 kids who wanted to get vaccinated, we would come. So we're always happy to support that if folks have decided to move forward with getting vaccinated.
I guess I would just reflect on the last week. I've had a couple of conversations with individuals who just were never going to and are never going to and aren't going to, and they're not going to be vaccinated. And, you know, those are valued members of my personal community. And I recognize that we have a difference of approach to how we do things in life. And they were really productive conversations. I felt like they were not antagonistic. They were just sharing where they were at. And I kind of appreciated hearing the openness and honesty, but some people are just never going to.
Oh, I mean, I did not successfully give away any of the $50 credit cards at the two food banks that I was like, hey, $50. No, so maybe people have made the decision one way or the other.
Yeah.
I think in most cases, yes. I appreciate the modeling of having that conversation in a peaceful and positive way. And we will always be here to support folks in getting vaccinated if they choose to move over. In Clallam County, we've been vaccinating at the public health department for quite some time, and we have been still seeing, you know, about 30 or 50 people on any given day come and get vaccinated. So it's still happening. And we're always happy to meet folks there. But I think there are some folks that have decided they're not going to get vaccinated. And so if that's the decision that folks have made, it's just important to make sure to use the other tools that we have To continue to mask in indoor spaces until we get to lower case thresholds is particularly important if you're unvaccinated. We have unfortunately lost far too many of our citizens to COVID-19. And of course, the vast majority of those are folks who are unvaccinated. And especially when we talk about losing young people to COVID-19, they're exclusively unvaccinated. And I don't want that to happen to anyone in Jefferson County. So it's important to use those other safety measures to keep yourself and your family safe.
Me neither. Don't want that to happen. Well, thanks, you guys. I don't know what we do when we have 7 minutes left and KPTZ is still rolling. Greg, you got your banjo in the corner there?
You know, it's fine. We don't want to leave dead air on the radio.
I'm sure they have a plan for this.
Maybe music. But we'll gift you back your time for the Board of County Commissioners. But thank you so much for the space, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you, Dr. Barry and Willie. See you next week.